You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is best-selling author Lisa See, the author of four highly regarded historical novels, as well as one memoir that explore Chinese and Chinese-American family dynamics through history, as well as three contemporary crime novels set in China and the United States. While family relationships are at the heart of most of her books, She has also explored the history of 17th and 19th century China, Shanghai and the Japanese invasion in the 1930s, the Chinese diaspora to the U.S. in the late 1800s, and in her latest book, Dreams of Joy, Mao Zedong's disastrous Great Leap Forward that led to ruinous famine and the death of untold millions. Dreams of Joy follows the story of sisters Pearl and May from her previous book, Shanghai Girls, this time focusing on their daughter Joy. When she discovers the woman she thought was her mother is actually her aunt, she runs away to Shanghai in early 1957 to find her birth father, the artist Z.G. Li, with whom both May and Pearl were once in love. And she finds herself right in the middle of the Great Leap Forward. It's a fascinating book. She's a wonderful writer exploring Chinese history and its different social dynamics. Dreams of Joy is now out in softcover from Random House, and she joins us today by phone. Lisa See, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's so nice to be back.
Yeah, it's been a while. We've got to talk about this latest book, Dreams of Joy, which follows on the story of Shanghai Girls, the sisters Pearl and May, and focuses on their daughter Joy. And I say their daughter because the true birth mother was kept secret from her. And this is how the novel begins. And this sort of information sends her a bit reeling, if you will. And it sends her back to China.
Yes. Well, she was actually born here in the United States, but it does send her off to China. It's 1957. China is, you know, closed. So it's probably not the best idea. And, you know, one of the first things I had to sort of deal with was our, and I include myself in this, our sort of preconception, misconception about how closed China actually was. You know, when I was growing up, we just all thought it was closed until President Nixon opened it. You know, I couldn't have opened it if it weren't closed. When I told my mom I was going to write this, she said, "Oh, honey, you know, this is going to be the shortest book you've ever written. Pearl and Joy fly to China, they get off the plane, they're taken out back and shot, the end." So I knew I had to sort of deal with that. But the fact is, there were a lot of people leaving China in those days, whether it was legally or illegally, and then a lot of people going in. A lot of Westerners went into China.
Well, I figure it's pretty much like Cuba. Cuba today.
Yeah, I suppose so. Like, although these were vast numbers of people going into China, a surprising number.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you quote in the book about 60,000 expatriate Chinese returned after the revolution, at least at this point in the book.
And, well, actually, 90,000 to Fujian province, just one province
alone.
In 1 year.
Wow.
So just, I mean, vast numbers, really vast numbers of people.
So did you get at the heart of why so many expatriate Chinese returned to China after the revolution? Was it?
It was not a political, I mean, I think for some, yes, it was a political thing. But really, I always think of it as, suppose instead of us being where we are today, we were, you know, all living as expatriates in Paris. And overnight there was some change in our government. And instead of being, you know, tomorrow morning we'd wake up and instead of it being the United States of America, it might be, I don't know, the United States of fun places to visit. And wouldn't we have a deep desire to come back here to make sure that our families were okay, to make sure that our houses and our businesses were okay, our possessions, you know, our whole lives that are here. But more than that sort of personal thing, this is our home country. This is our home. And so wouldn't we have this desire to come back and be a part of rebuilding it? You know, we can look back in hindsight and see that there were a lot of terrible mistakes happened in China. In that time, terrible things happened. But in the first flush, you know, people had a tremendous amount of optimism about what was going to happen, and people wanted to be a part of that because it was their home country.
And in fact, Joy is a sort of a mix of this. You know, she has grown up with life in the United States, and everything she knows to be true is false because it turns out that her aunt is her mother.
Right.
Her mother is her aunt. Her father, her believed father, has died. And she has a bit of this idealism, and she's also being exposed to propaganda at her university. So it's a mixture of politics and the personal.
That's right. Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. And, you know, she's 19. So a lot of us do things when we're 19 that, you know, hopefully you don't get into such trouble. You know, you may drink and drive once and maybe you got away with it, but, you know, that doesn't mean that you run off to another country. So, one of the things that I really like about Joy, or that I really am very proud of with Dreams of Joy, is that, you know, sometimes when we watch movies or we watch TV, somebody makes a mistake, but they are able to fix it very quickly. But in real life, what happens is you make a mistake, and sometimes you're able to fix it. But oftentimes, that's just the first of what will become many mistakes, that you make one mistake, which leads to the next mistake, which leads to the next one. And then how do you get out of it then? And so that is what happens to Joy. You know, she starts out, and she doesn't think she's making a mistake, but then she does seem to make a series of mistakes. And fortunately, her mother is coming right behind her and is there really to help her, even though it seems at one point like it's not going to work, but, you know, help her daughter, save her daughter. And
when you say her mother, it's her aunt.
It's really her aunt, but
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but that, and that's really at the heart of the book, this relationship between mother and daughter, even though they're not mother and daughter.
You know? Right. I mean, to me, the very heart of the novel is that mother-daughter relationship. And I think of this proverb or aphorism, mothers suffer, children do what they want. And, you know, that's really true in life. That can be anywhere you go in the world. And, you know, not everybody has children, but pretty much everyone somewhere along the line had a mother. And so I've been very interested in that idea. You know, I am a daughter myself, but I'm also a mother. And so what is it that makes a good mother? We see the bad mothers on television, you know, Casey Anthony, people like that. But what makes an incredible mother? What makes even an average mother? And I think of certain things that, you know, it takes incredible sacrifice, that a mother will sacrifice anything to make sure that her child is safe, happy, healthy, alive, and that sometimes it takes extraordinary courage, you know, to make those things happen. And then also that a mother is the most loyal person there is to you. You know, when I was growing up, and I used to think that this was very rare, that I was, you know, the only person somebody, my mother said this to, but it turns out a lot of mothers say this because people tell me. But my mother, when I was growing up, she'd say, you know, even if you become an axe murderer, I'll still love you. And, you know, I haven't yet, but I think that there's something to that, that, you know, there is no one who is more loyal to you, who will stand by you, than your own mother. And so I really was trying to look at that. And what makes a mother? Is it actually birth, you know, giving birth to a child? Is it somebody like Pearl who is actually Joy's aunt but has raised Pearl from birth? And then even on Joy's side, you know, how she looks at her mother, and then as she becomes a mother herself, what she understands now about her mother, but also what she learns and how she learns to be a good mother.
And this is the story of love, is Pearl following her daughter. This is a character that, if anything, is very fearful of going back to China. She left a China that she felt like she knew very well. And to go back, that, you know, that's a great act of courage. And you write very eloquently of how she puts that aside.
Well, you know, and it's not just what she's leaving, going back to that is new and different, but she has a, you know, she knows that it's now a communist country. She knows it's now a closed country. And I think she has a very different view than her daughter of what that means, a more realistic view. And, you know, certainly not idealistic in any way. And so she's going back to a place that's not the home of her childhood, and yet she can find her childhood. Nevertheless, is still, you know, her childhood home is still there. The people who live there are still there. So, you know, I think she's also on this kind of path of self-discovery and learning. You know, she from Shanghai Girls, Pearl went through an awful lot in that book, and she goes through an awful lot in this one too. But I think she's able to finally resolve things and have a happy ending. You know, people often say to me, you know, your books don't have a happy ending. And they don't, you know, and, oh, your books really make me cry. They're so sad. And yeah, that's true. But this time I really wanted a happy ending. And mm-hmm. there is one, you know, yeah, there really there is one. Even though there's a place about three quarters of the way through, you'll think, oh, no, there's no way.
My guest today is Lisa C., the best-selling author. Her latest book, Dreams of Joy, is now published in softcover by Random House. She joins us by phone today here on Studio Tulsa. Well, you said this, when Joy decides to go back, it coincides with the beginning of the Great Leap Forward, which, for, you know, for most Westerners, we look at this and we just shake our heads. It's an absolute puzzlement. This, I guess, purge towards sort of communist purity. It's about bridging the gap between city and countryside. And this is at the heart of the story of where Joy goes back to.
Right. You know, I always have history in my books. You know, they are historical novels, and I'm always interested in stories that have been lost, forgotten, deliberately covered up. The Great Leap Forward is a great example of that. But I'm also interested, I mean, what to me is the most interesting is, how do people move through history? You know, our parents did it, our great-grandparents, our grandparents, you know, we're doing it right now as we're sitting here doing this interview, that history is happening to us. And so, to me, what I find compelling is, what happens in these moments of history? You know, do you succeed or do you fail? Do you do the honorable and moral thing, or do you lose your moral center and go in a whole other direction? You know, the Great Leap Forward started out with good intentions. The idea was that China was going to literally have a great leap forward in terms of agriculture production and steel production, so feeding people and doing industry. And it's interesting because, you know, you could say that China is in the midst of a great leap forward right this minute, right?
Yes.
Now on the verge of becoming the greatest economic superpower. So just behind the United States. And so this was, whatever, 50, 60 years ago. And they had this idea of, we're going to jump ahead. And unfortunately, the ways that they wanted to do it were what I can only describe as being kind of cockamamie, you know. People across the country were ordered to go into their houses, their schools, where they worked, out onto the street, and find every piece of metal they could find, their farm implements, their cooking utensils, their door hinges, their hairpins, any piece of metal that they could find, take it out to what were called backyard furnaces, where it would be melted down into pig iron and sent off to the government to be turned into steel. Of course, it wasn't going to work. It never could work. But there's an unintended consequence if you melt down your cooking utensils and farm implements. You know, and so there were things like, people were ordered on the farming side, you know, instead of planting one seed in a spot, to plant 10 seeds in one spot, with the idea that now you'd get 10 times the amount of wheat, 10 times the amount of carrots, 10 times the amount of cabbages. Well, anybody who's ever grown anything knows that's not going to work.
Or, you know, or farmers who have traditionally grown rice, all of a sudden you're going to grow wheat. And it's, this
right.
land's not suited for wheat. No,
exactly.
You're going to grow wheat.
Yeah. So yeah. There were all these, you know, they had these ideas that, again, I just think of as being cockamamie, you know, just made no sense whatsoever. And the consequences of that became apparent very quickly. And so scholars have been arguing for years, you know, how many people actually died during the Great Leap Forward? Was it 10 million? Was it 100 million? And recent documents released by China seem to suggest it was about 45 million people who starved to death within 3 years. And, you know, when I was there in China doing research for this, so just 2 years ago, and people would say, oh, you know, Lisa, what are you working on now? And I'd say, oh, it's a novel that has the Great Leap Forward as its backdrop. And they'd say, oh, yes, the 3 years of bad weather, because that's how
that's
they've learned it. You know,
wow.
I mean, when I talk about history being lost, forgotten, deliberately covered up, I'm serious in this instance. So there's been very, very little written about this time period. As far as I know, this is the only novel that has this as its backdrop.
And how Joy ends up there is that her birth father, an artist who played in Shanghai Girls 2, this artist who drew the sisters, I suppose this is the political part of the Great Leap Forward. He was determined to be decadent in some way, and he's sent to the countryside to... It's not necessarily...
Teach peasants art. Yeah, he's actually trying to avoid being in trouble. So he sort of goes out to the countryside to teach peasants art. And this was one of the things was, you know, how you can teach peasants and get the people, everybody, to produce as much as possible in a 24-hour period, whether it was flashlights or, you know, grain harvest or posters, all these different things. And, you know, Ziji in Shanghai Girls is a commercial artist painting these what were called beautiful girls who were selling, you know, matches and motor oil and whatever, you know, true advertising. But what they were really selling was this idea of a new modern Chinese woman who was going to help change China. And so now, though, in 1957, he's still an artist, but that kind of advertising art has now turned into political propaganda. And he's still painting beautiful girls, only the beautiful girls, or the idea of what is a beautiful girl, has changed. She's no longer, you know, resting in her boudoir with her beautiful gown and lovely makeup. She's a little heavier. She has her hair in pigtails. Her cheeks are sunburned by the sun. And she's out and, you know, driving a tractor, building a dam. Again, this idea of a new modern Chinese woman who's going to help transform the country. But he's, poor Ziji, he's just always just trying to stay one step ahead of real trouble. Because a true artist is always, you know, on the verge of being in trouble. You know, can't really produce propaganda for always.
Yeah. You set the countryside, this sort of, the book sort of traverses from Shanghai to this fictional, I assume, village, Green Dragon Village. Did you go out to the countryside? Has, you know, I would think things have changed somewhat, but we hear about this divide between urban China and rural China. Does it still exist?
Oh my gosh, yes. It is unbelievable, the difference. You know, so Shanghai today is one of the wealthiest, most modern, most populous cities on the planet. Green Dragon is, you know, where I set the novel. It's, as you said, called Green Dragon, but that's based on the village of Wangsun, which is in Anhui province, 200 miles from Shanghai. Just 200 miles. To get there, it takes about 10 hours. They speak a completely different dialect. You cannot, you know, if you're from Shanghai, you can't understand what they say in Wangsun. It's like you go, you know, you go 100, 200 miles out of a big city, and it's as though you're stepping back in time 100, 200, 300 years. You know, yes, they have electricity, one electric light bulb, enough electricity for a television. But that will be it, you know, no refrigeration, no indoor plumbing, it's still very, very rough in the countryside. And this is one of the reasons why today, you know, China is in the midst of, even as it's becoming a global economic superpower, is in the midst of the greatest human migration in the history of the world, as people leave the countryside and go to the cities to try to become part of that economic change and revolution. Because the difference, I mean, here's just a comparison. This, you know, is not part of Dreams of Joy, but just because we're talking about today, cities, towns, villages along the coast of China now have a greater median income than the United States. When you go out to the countryside, people are still making maybe a dollar a day. So that's a huge difference, and it's one of the things that is really a problem for China. You know, so we can look at it now on the surface as looking like it is a global economic superpower, but it's really kind of paper thin.
Yeah, that's
because the vast majority of people are still living not just, you know, in poverty, but really not even in the modern world.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, because you're describing this in 1958 when it still existed then. If anything, it's still there today. And in fact, the people in the countryside, when they come to the cities, they have even a bigger disconnect than, say, 50 years ago when the city people were going to the country. And this sort of cultural dis-ease of just reeling from the change in culture, this is a major issue for China today. It was a major issue in the time of your book, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it continues to be. And it's actually one of the things that I think is most frightening for the government of China, because every dynasty in the history of the country, 5,000 years, change has come from the countryside. People who have felt that the government has become too corrupt, or that their needs aren't being served, or, you know, they're not getting enough water, or they're not part of moving the country forward, whatever it is, every change over 5,000 years has come from peasants in the countryside. And so certainly the government of China is very aware of that. They don't forget their history.
My guest today is Lisa C., the best-selling author. Her latest book, Dreams of Joy, is now in softcover by Random House. In our remaining time, one of the things I really love about your books is you tell a great story, but you're also sort of talking about these things we've been talking about in the last few minutes, these social issues that inform the time. How important is that for you to convey in your story? Is it essential to the story, to understanding who these people are? This, you know, and you've done it 17th century China, 19th century China, Shanghai when it was the open city of the West in the 30s, now China under Mao.
Well, when I first started writing, and I've always written about China, the Chinese American experience, people didn't really think that much about China. It wasn't on our radar. But now I think it's very much on our radar. And, China is now the largest landowner in the United States. I mean, there are just a lot of things that we should be aware of and we should be paying attention to with this country. And yet I don't think you can just look at it as it is this minute. You have to have a sense of what happened before, what motivates individual people, but also an entire country, and what's behind that. It's like if you looked at the United States and you just looked at us today and didn't think about the ways that we had grown and learned as a country through World War II, the Depression, Civil War. These are so much a part of our national psyche, really. You know, that's part of who we are. We may not have personally lived through the Civil War, but it is part of our history and our culture. And, you know, as I've been on book tour this time, I've spent a lot of time in the South this time around. And, you know, you still see that sense of how important the Civil War is still today. So if you looked, you know, if you were just on the outside looking in and you just saw our, I don't know, our what was on television, and you believe, you know, our TV shows, one of our great imports, or our movies, you know, another great import to the rest of the
world.
You
think somebody's getting killed every second, murdered every second.
Yeah, but it doesn't really tell people who we are as a nation. And that would be a great disservice to other people about how they looked at us. Well, I think China is going to become more and more important in the world, and we need to know who those people are, what that country is, and who they are beyond that sort of surface image that we get.
It's a very, you know, an old country, 5,000 years of history, and yet it's a young country at the same time.
Yes, very much. Yes, very much. Because this, you know, the form it has now, it's only since 1949. So it's a very young country.
One of the things I wanted to talk about this, because we in the West don't have the same, we look at it like astrology, and it's, you know, maybe a few, some people do consider it somewhat serious, but you know, being a tiger child as Joy is, and the year sort of, the astrology side of that, this is far more important in these people's lives. I wanted to ask about that because throughout the book, you know, people, characters are, as they're coming to grips with the situation, they said, well, I'm, you know, in Joy's case, a tiger.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I do think you have to look at it a little bit like we do here. You know, some people really follow astrology. Some people look at, you know, take a glance in the newspaper and see, oh, what did it say today? You sort of, if it's a good one, you believe it. If it's a bad one, they're wrong. You know, and some people pay no attention to it at all. Some people use it as a pickup line in a bar. But in China, you know, there it is deeper. Yes, there's a sort of range of how people look at it, but it is deeper. And, for example, this is the year of the dragon. The dragon is considered the strongest, best of all of the astrological signs. And so there will be more children born, more babies born this year in China, but also outside of China for Chinese families, than in, you know, during any of the other signs, because people want to have a child who's born in the year of the dragon because it has such good luck and is seen as the strongest, most powerful sign. Mm. So, you know, that's it's the Chinese horoscope and zodiac is very complex, and people use it in their daily life. And sometimes it'll be kind of in a frivolous way or joking way, in the sense that you would say, like, oh, a horse should never marry a rooster because the rooster will always ride on the horse's back. You know, so there's a lot about what these signs mean in terms of marriage or mothers-in-law or your children, you know, what kind of a child you're going to have.
And, of course, it makes a great literary device as
well. Yes, it does. Yeah, it does.
Lisa, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Novelist Lisa C., the best-selling author, her latest book, Dreams of Joy, is now in softcover by Random House. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.